We are in the beginning of Chayei Sara still, and we are on page 108 and 109. I mentioned to you last time that I was going to share with you anybody remember what I said? Remember?
That's right.
That's right. This was the class that Rabbi Deutsch delivered in Chattanooga for the Shabbaton that we had when I was visiting here on a seed program 19 years ago. Before we get to that, we have to have a little bit more background here about the purchase of the Ma'aras HaMachpelah, the burial plot for Sarah, would ultimately be the burial plot for all of our patriarchs and matriarchs, except for Rachel. But I'll warn you when we get to Rabbi Deitch's word. Let's read from. We talked last time about Ephron and about how he said he would give it to Avram for free. In the end, he charged an exorbitant sum. We said that. We said how the land itself was very special because this would be the connection forever after between the bodies of the physical bodies of the Avos and the Imos, the patriarchs and matriarchs, and their souls. In which case, that's where we connect with them as well, is by going to visit that that place. And we talked about visiting the graves in general. But here we have an interesting set of psukim, some verses. After Avram purchases the plot, starting from Yud Zion 17, it says, Vayakam Sedei Ephron, and the field of Ephron literally got up. Asher b'machpelah, that was in the Machpelah, in the double area. Asher lifnei Mamre, what that was before Mamre. Hasadeh v'hameara asher bo, the field and the cave that was in it. B'chol ha'etz asher b'hasadeh, and all the trees that were in the field. Asher b'chol gvulo saviv, that was in all of the boundaries around. Le'Avraham le'miknah le'inei b'nei ches, to Avraham as a purchase in the eyes of the b'nei ches. And all those that came into the gate of the city. The entire area, not just the actual cave, but the field, the trees, everything, went to Avraham. And afterwards, kavar Avraham as Sarah Ishtel. And afterwards, Avraham buried Sarah, his wife, El Me'aras Sedei HaMachpelah, to the cave of the field that is doubled. Alpnei Mamre, on the face of Mamre, that's where it was. He Chevron, that is Chevron Beretz Canaan, in the land of Canaan. Vayakam Hasadeh, and the field got up, rose up. Vehamera Sherbo, and the cave that was in it. LeAvraham, to Avraham, Achuzas Kaver, as a burial plot, a permanent burial plot. Me'es B'nei Ches, from the children of Ches. So, our sages point out this verb, vayakam, both in Yud Zayin 17 and in Chav 20. Vayakam Sedei Ephron, vayakam hasadeh, the field rose up. It's an interesting verb to use. What the point the Torah is trying to convey is that the field changed hands. It went from Ephron to Avraham. But the way the Torah chooses to express it is with this verb, vayakam, and it rose up. So how would you explain the usage?
Elevated.
It's elevated, exactly. That's exactly what our sages tell us. The land became elevated. It went from the hands of a hedyot, of a simpleton, to the hands of a melech, to the hands of a king, to the hands of Avraham. The field itself became elevated. Now, this is a fascinating point, and this will touch off a discussion which we'll have right now about possessions. The Jewish outlook on possessions. It's a fascinating thing. I understand Avraham is exalted, and I understand Ephron was a scoundrel. Fine. Why does that mean the field is elevated when it goes from the possession of Ephron to the possession of Avraham? It's only a field. The field is an inanimate object. The field has no spirituality to it. It has no free will. It has no power. It's not a person. How does the field become elevated just because now the one whose name is on the deed is Avraham instead of Ephraim?
Well, certain land is holy. I mean, certain land, obviously, has the sacredness toward it.
Okay, now.
If you're going to bury the patriarch there, surely it has a sacred holiness.
Okay. Okay, that's good. That's good. So the burial of the patriarchs and matriarchs there is going to give it a holiness, just as the Temple Mount has holiness, and just as Mount Sinai had holiness when the Torah was given on it. It's an interesting thing. Mount Sinai today has no holiness to it. It was only holy for the time the Torah was given. The Temple Mount continues to be holy. It's an interesting difference. But places can be holy. So the burial of Sarah made the place holy. Let's hold that thought, because this is prior to the burial of Sarah. It says the land became elevated when it went from the possession of Ephron to the possession of Avram. So you're correct that the burial of Sarah gives it holiness. But it seems that there's an elevation to the land even prior to the burial of Sarah, just because Abraham now purchased it.
When you say elevation, do you mean, in which way do you mean? What?
That's part of the question.
That's part of the question.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, in worth, in value, and does the ground actually go up physically?
Right. So, okay, so we're not talking about physically. The land has not actually risen up in the air. It's hard to believe we're talking about value because Abraham just purchased it for an exorbitant sum. So he already paid a tremendous amount of money. To say that it's worth even more, perhaps, now we can say it's priceless. Perhaps that's true. But our sages, Chazal, seem to be saying that there's a spiritual elevation to the land itself. Even though land is not a person, land has no free will.
One example in the Torah directly is when you have Korah, you're found in the house.
Correct.
So there is a connection.
Very good.
A spiritual connection.
Between the person.
Between the person and the house.
And the house.
Right.
Good.
That's one. And there also would say that when you think of the place of someone who has lived in the place, it becomes the soul of the person.
Okay, excellent. Say. Excellent.
So,
okay. The Gemara tells us, Adam Karov Eitzel Mamono. A person, literally the words mean, this is not actually what the intent is, but literally the words mean, a person is a relative with his possessions. Just as you're a relative with your brother or your sister, you're a relative with your possessions. Your possessions are your relatives. What does that mean? What it means is there is a connection between person and possessions. It's not simply that society had to figure out some way of coexisting, so we created this concept, this notion called ownership. That if I own a house and you own a house, that in reality, meaning if we would divest ourselves of all human input, in reality, it's not your house, it's not my house, it's just houses. I happen to be in one house, you happen to be in the other house. And it's only a societal thing that we've decided, we'll call this one yours, and you have control over it, I'll call this one mine, and I have control over it. No. The Torah is saying possession is an inherent thing. When God created the world, actually when he created people, he created the concept of ownership. And ownership means control. When he created Adam, he created Adam after he had created the whole universe. And then he created Adam. And he placed Adam in this world and gave Adam shlita, gave Adam power, control over the world. It is his. Now, of course, it's not really his, it's God's. But God entrusted the world to Adam. And his descendants continue that ownership. And as the world expands and more people come into the world, so the pie is divided up into more pieces. We talked about when Cain and Hevel had their struggle, and Cain killed Hevel, we talked about how that struggle was far bigger than a simple disagreement between brothers. They were fighting over control of the entire world. Who would be the next Adam and who would be subordinate? That was what was going on over there. And it was an eternal struggle. Possessions, having possession of something, is recognized by the Torah as an innate facet of creation. What that means, it brings out an entire, if you haven't thought about it before, it brings out an entirely new way of looking at possessions. The land, as long as it was owned by Ephron, was considered to be a simpleton's land. The land itself did not have spiritual value. When it went from Ephron to Abraham, it now became spiritual, simply because Abraham, who himself was the most spiritual person alive at the time, now that Sarai had passed away, so he's the only one, Yitzchak was alive, but Abraham was greater at the time, almost at the end of his life, then land itself became spiritual then. And that's what's being said over here by Yaakov. It rose up. It became elevated simply by being owned by Abraham. Now, Mr. Jeter pointed out an excellent thing, which is it's not only the ownership of Abraham, but it's the burial of Sarah as well that gives it holiness, which you really preempted my second question. My second question was going to be, why does it say by Yaakov twice? It became elevated. But if we look carefully at the verses, the first time it says it became elevated, that was when it transferred ownership. Then it says Abraham buried Sarah, and then it says it became elevated a second time. So there was a second level of elevation once Sarah was actually buried in the land. That's easier for us to understand. It is that first step that is more, which is the greater chiddush, it's the greater novelty, which is what we're bringing out over here. That there is this elevation in spirituality because of the fact that Abraham owned it. Now, let's discuss for a moment the spirituality of inanimate objects. This table. Is this table a spiritual table? It's a table. A bit of wood. It does its job. But does this table have greater spirituality here in this room than it did in the showroom wherever it was purchased from a few years ago? What do you think? Because we're learning Torah on this table. The table is facilitating the learning of Torah. That gives the table a certain spirituality. Now, it doesn't benefit the table. The table has no reward and punishment. The table just is. But it means that this table is doing that which God, we hope, that which God placed it in the world to do. This table was made from trees and other materials. God placed those materials in the world. He didn't place them there for no reason. He placed them there for our benefit. Now, a tree could be for our benefit because of its beauty. It could be for our benefit because of the fruit that it bears. It could be for our benefit because of the ecology that it provides. It can also be for our benefit for making a table upon which we can study Torah. That when that happens, then its purpose has been fulfilled. Now, we don't know for a fact that that was the purpose of this particular tree that was felled to make this table. But I'm bringing out the concept that everything is in this world for a reason. From the tallest mountain to the tiniest ant, every single thing has a purpose and a reason. And they are brought to their fruition and brought to their completion by our use of those objects. And so the land can become spiritual when it is used properly. As we mentioned, simply being owned by Abraham gives it a certain spirituality. Perhaps the one of the most powerful examples of this idea is with sacrifices. A sacrifice. You take an animal and you bring it to the temple, to the Beis HaMikdash, and it's made into one particular sacrifice of all the different types that there are, and you give it to the Kohen. And what does the Kohen do? The Kohen slaughters the animal, attaches the blood, takes the blood to the altar, throws the blood on the altar, takes the animal that is now dead, cuts the animal up into prescribed pieces, that the Torah says, and then various things happen to those pieces depending on the type of sacrifice that it is. Some of the pieces get burned on the altar. Others get eaten by the Kohanim. Others get eaten by the owner of the sacrifice. All of this takes place with an animal. Now, this animal was a living, breathing animal before it turned into a sacrifice. What has happened to this animal? What has happened to this animal is the animal has reached a certain level of completion, of fruition, of spirituality, meaning its purpose has been served. Animals are placed in this world for the purpose of man. Some are for the purpose of food. Some are for the purpose of providing clothing. Some are for the purpose of companionship. Some are for the ecology. Some are for ridding us of pests. There are various reasons for animals, but they all have a purpose. Some animals are placed in the world for sacrifice. And when that happens, there's a certain completion, a certain spirituality which the animal now has. When we eat food and we recite a bracha over the food, a blessing over the food, that too gives the inanimate object a certain spirituality. The object has become part of the process of our serving Hashem. And that is the best that an inanimate object can hope for. My Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Weinberg of blessed memory, used to say the following. Avraham bought the land from Ephron. So whose land is it? Today, whose land is it? Well, Avram's dead.
His descendants.
So that's us. So we own the land. That's true. From here on in, until the end of Bereshis, the Ma'aras HaMachpelah is mentioned several times. When another patriarch or matriarch dies and is buried, the Torah mentions the Ma'aras HaMachpelah. Every time it's mentioned, it's called the Ma'ara of Ephron. It's always called Ephron's cave. It's always called Ephron's cave, which is striking. What do you mean Ephron's cave? Avram purchased it. Not only did he purchase it, he paid an exorbitant price. Why is it called Ephron's cave? So my Rosh Yeshiva said that because when you own something, as we mentioned before, there is a relationship, almost a familial relationship, between you and your object. Even after you sell it, that relationship endures. And so this land, which had once been Ephron's, forever, it's not that it is owned by Ephron, we own the land, but there's always a connection. It is remembered as Ephron's cave, Ephron's land. That's how it is mentioned in the Torah, because he's the one who owned it first. You can also add to this, my Rosh Hashanah, I don't believe, said this, but you can add Eretz Kenan, the land of Kenan, which is what it's called throughout, even though later it does become Eretz Yisrael, but we refer to Eretz Kenan throughout the Torah, because it was inhabited by the Kenanim before us. My Rosh Yeshiva used this in a shmooze, in a talk to us, about ownership of objects, which is what we're talking about now. And he used to say that when we own something, make no mistake, there is a relationship between us and our object. And what he said is that a person could think, everybody grows throughout their lifetime. Certainly everybody in this room, myself included, I hope, we've grown as we have gotten older, and we look back on our lives and we say we are further ahead now than we were before. We're closer to Hashem now than we were before, which is great. But because we weren't always where we are now, we had other ways before, all of us, doesn't matter whether you're a Baal Tshuva, an FFB, makes no difference. Everybody had, when they were younger, a certain way of acting, and hopefully as they've gotten older, they've grown. But because we had a former way that we were, so we may own certain things that we no longer use, because now it's beneath us to use the object, because we've grown beyond that. I'll give an example which may not apply to everybody in the room, but you can have a family that owns several televisions, and as they have grown, have decided, we're not going to watch television anymore, it's not appropriate. They may have decided that. But they still own the televisions. They're tucked away in a closet. So what my Rosh Hashiva pointed out is that continuing to own the object means there still is a relationship between oneself and one's object. And therefore, there is a lingering effect that the object has. It's not an overt effect. It's a subtle effect. But it's still there. And therefore, he encouraged us that if we have anything, he was probably referring to televisions, I don't know what he was referring to, but if we have anything that we no longer use because we feel it's beneath us, it is appropriate to rid ourselves of it, not simply to tuck it away in a closet, because there is a relationship between ourselves and our objects. Yes?
If Upfront sold the land,
yes,
then why, if it's not in his possession anymore, why then it seems to contradict?
Yeah, well, he's saying that there still is a residual effect. It's just that it's stronger if you continue to own it. But there's always a residual effect. Also, it could be land is even more potent than other things. We know land is the most important object that a person can own, especially land in Israel. That's the strongest possession a person has, most powerful possession a person has.
And it would never go back to Ephraim on Yovel.
No. This is purchased completely. Yeah.
So if you own dishes that you know to be trays,
okay.
Or that you know
I was
are
wondering what examples would come
what
up?
What are trays? Okay, so
what would people admit to?
yeah, I'm working on this. So we own dishes that we know are trays because, for example, the dairy dishes had trace cheese on them before I knew there was such a thing as kosher cheese. So we're working on this.
What are the dishes made of?
So I brought one of them to Rabbi Feldman. He said, okay, put this away for a year, and then we'll look at it again and we'll
okay.
see.
Okay, good.
So, and I brought him the other set piece another day, but he didn't get to look at it. So far, only one set. So they're in my possession, and I'm assuming that when he looks at it again, he'll either say, well, you really can't kosher this, but now that you haven't used it for a year, maybe you don't need it anymore. I don't know. Or maybe he'll say, this is what you should do.
Right.
So, but if it weren't, say I knew there was a set that couldn't be koshered for whatever reason, if I had found that out, keeping it in my possession could be detrimental.
I don't know if it would apply over here, because there's nothing wrong with the dish. You can't use it, right? You can't use the dish. You could use the dish if you want as a display. You could use the dish to put flowers on it. And there's nothing wrong with the dish.
Well, same with the TV in the closet.
Yeah, I guess theoretically that's true. You know, I once traveled. We once, when I was single, my roommate and I traveled from Baltimore to St. Louis to do a seed program in St. Louis. I did many seed programs when I was younger. So we did a seed program in St. Louis, and we rented a car in Baltimore and drove to St. Louis, and then we drove it back at the end of the seed program. So we could have done the trip in one day, but they allowed us to take a night, so we wouldn't have to do the whole drive in one day. So both there and back, we stopped somewhere in a motel overnight. So we walked into the motel, and of course there's a TV in the motel, but we're two yeshiva bacharim, so we walked in. So my roommate, who now is a Rebbe, in Neri Yisrael in Baltimore. He actually now is my son's Rebbe in Neri Yisrael in Baltimore. He walked in, and the first thing he did was he took off his jacket and draped it over the front of the television. That was the first thing he did. And then the next morning, when we were ready to leave, he took his jacket off, and we walked out the door. Both directions, that's what he did. So we wouldn't be tempted to watch the TV. So he joked as we got back in the car, when he gets married, he's going to buy a television to have in his house to have a place to hang his coat. Right. So I think with dishes also, there are certain dishes that after a year are permissible, depending on the situation, which is probably what Rabbi Feldman will decide after the year is over. So in your case, it's likely that it's simply the process of making it permissible to use. And so I don't know if in that case it would be the same thing. I think, eating is not inherently bad. There's eating which is bad and eating which is good, but eating is not inherently bad. But I'll tell you what, after my Rosh Hashiva said this talk, what I did is I went into my closet. I had been given a book once by a relative, unfortunately a relative of mine, who had written a book about heaven. But this book wasn't a Jewish book. It was a book about all types of religions and their view on heaven. So it contained a great deal of heresy in the book. And I never read it. I just tucked it away because it was a relative of mine, so I just put it away. But after my Rosh Hashiva had this talk, I decided it wasn't appropriate to keep the book at all. So I got rid of the book after that. So that was the application of this talk. So. At any rate, I'm not really advocating you go through your possessions and throw things out. I'm just trying to bring out the point of the relationship between us and our possessions, which I don't think people think about too much. Especially in our society where we own so much. Even those who don't have a lot of money own a lot of things in America, which our ancestors didn't have, the kind of things that we have. A lot of things. It's so easy to buy things, and we throw things out, it's disposable, etc. So I don't think we think about ownership. And the Torah really has a very powerful view on ownership of possessions. Now, from here we can move to Rabbi Deitch's talk 19 years ago. As I shared with everybody before, that 19 years ago I was here on the student program, and we had done a Shabbaton in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and with Rabbi Deitch. And Rabbi Deitch gave a talk on Sunday morning, and it had to do with this discussion here of Avraham's purchase of the Ma'arat HaMachpelah, which I want to share with you now. And ties in with everything we said tonight. There are three places, and only three places, in Tanakh, in Scripture, that are recorded to have been purchased by our ancestors. Meaning the whole land was given to us, but there are only three places that were actually purchased legally. Not just won by a war, which is also considered legal ownership by the Torah, but actually purchased with money. Three different places. Did I mention the three last week? I did. Remember what they were? Okay, obviously Maras HaMachpelah, Hebron is one of them. The Beis HaMikdash, the Har Moriah, the Temple Mount was purchased by David HaMelech. King David purchased it. Tevarachal was not purchased.
Yosef?
That's right. Yosef. Which is where? Where's Yosef? Yosef is in Shechem. Shechem, which is today called Nablus. But that is also, those three places were actually purchased with money, with a deed of sale by our ancestors. Abraham purchased Hebron, right here. Yaakov purchases Shechem in Parashas Vayishlach, which we'll get to in many, many, many weeks, perhaps months. And David HaMelech purchased the Temple Mount, Har HaMoriah, from Aravna Yerusi. He purchased it from a non-Jew. Now, the Rabbi Deitch did this very dramatically with a map, and then the transparency that went over the map. That's how he did this. But he showed the map of Israel, and he showed these three areas. Oh, and he added one more point. One more point. The we know that when the Jews came into Israel the first time under Yehoshua, under Joshua, they conquered most of the land that they were supposed to conquer. And it was a vast conquer compared to later. Meaning, and it was larger than the current state of Israel. They conquered the entire area that is currently the state of Israel, including, of course, the West Bank. They also conquered the East Bank, which is most of the country of Jordan. They also conquered most of the country of Lebanon. They also conquered much of the country of Syria. All of this area was conquered by the Jewish people when we first entered Israel. And when you get to the reign of Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, which is at the height of the empire, it included, as I said, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, perhaps a little bit of Saudi Arabia, which is a very large area, in relatively speaking. That was what we'll call the first Commonwealth. And that lasted throughout the first Beis HaMikdash, the first temple. Towards the end of the first temple period, they lost land. They were whittled down to size as time went on, conquered by various foreign countries, and eventually Yerushalayim was destroyed. It was sacked, and then the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed by Babylonia and Nebuchadnezzar. The second Commonwealth, which was the Jews coming back to Israel to rebuild the temple under Ezra, that was a very relatively small area that they conquered. Does anybody know where that area is? Obviously, Yerushalayim, Jerusalem. Does anybody know where else, what that area was that was conquered the second time? Not conquered, was inhabited the second time by the Jewish people. It's roughly the West Bank. It's about the boundaries that they had under the second temple. When they... primarily. Yeah. When they came in the first time, they consecrated the land. They made the land holy. And the land became the area of the Eretz Yisrael. The Torah says where the boundaries are. And that area is the area, for example, that when you harvest crops, you have to take off Truma and Maaser. You have to take off tithes. And all the laws that apply to the land, the agriculture of Israel, Shemitah, first temple, right? The whole area had various, some of those parts had slightly different laws than other of those parts, but they all came under the general guidelines of Eretz Yisrael, and had the mitzvos, hatzluyos, bars, had the commandments that are dependent on the land. When they came in the second time, they did not consecrate all of that land. Even though some may have lived beyond the West Bank boundaries, but they did not consecrate the rest of the land. They only consecrated Jerusalem, of course, and the area around Jerusalem, which is primarily the West Bank today. Which means that if you live today in Israel, in the far northern areas, you are in an area, or let's say around Haifa, for example, you are in an area that had been kadosh, had been holy under the first temple, but not under the second temple. What difference does that make? The difference is this. For various reasons, which is beyond the scope of tonight's class, the rule is as follows. Whatever was consecrated, whatever was holy in the time of the first temple, that Kedusha, that holiness, was removed when the Jews went into exile. Whatever was rededicated when we came up the second time, even after we went into exile, still remains holy. That's why we can't go beyond the Kosel, beyond the western wall, the Wailing Wall, because that area is still holy. It still has the holiness of the temple. That's why if you are in Israel, you have to deal with the laws of tithing. You have to deal with the laws of Shemitah, which is this coming year. These laws apply because the area is still holy. Because that which was made holy the second time was not, did not become removed after the Jews left. So if you're living in Haifa, are you living in Israel? Yes, you are. Are you living in a place that was once holy? Yes. Is it still holy? In many ways, no. Meaning, of course, it still has holiness. It's still Israel. But it's not as holy, as kadosh, as the West Bank, which there the Kedusha endures to today. Now, here was the point that Rabbi Detsch made. Rabbi Detsch cited a passage of the Ramban, Nachmanides, who says that the holier a place is in Israel, the greater challenge it is for us to have possession of it. As we mentioned, having possession is a powerful force. And for us to take possession of land, it is more difficult for us to take possession of a place which is holier. Now think about it. The entire land of Israel is holy. And we Jews were not able to take possession of the land of Israel for almost 2,000 years. Finally, we were able to take possession of the land of Israel. It was holy. It was very difficult to take possession of it. But even when we got possession in 1948, what did we get possession of? Everything except for the West Bank. We didn't get the West Bank. We didn't get the Temple Mount. We didn't get that whole area. We don't understand the workings of history, but it fits in perfectly with what the Ramban is saying. Because the area that we got, although it is holy because it is the land of Israel, but it is the least holy of the lands of Israel. In 1967, Baruch Hashem, thank God, we were able to take the West Bank, including the Temple Mount, which are the more holy areas. But it is the area that is harder for us to hold on to, because it's holier. It demands more of us, and it is more difficult to sustain, because it is holier. And Rabbi Deitch pointed out that the three places in Israel which were actually purchased by our ancestors, which means that their relationship to the land was stronger in those three places than the rest of the land of Israel, that means that the holiness, the Kedusha that those three places have are more elevated than the rest of the land of Israel. That is, of course, the Temple Mount, Hebron, which we just learned about here, and Shechem. Those three places are the three places that are the most difficult to maintain control over. And even before this nonsense with the West Bank that's been going on for the past number of years, but even since 67, the areas that we have had the most trouble with have been Yerushalayim, Shechem, and Hebron. Even if you go back to the early 80s, go back to the late 70s, early 80s, before all this business with Intifada and all that business, whatever's going on today, before all of that. But Jews knew Shechem was a dangerous place to go. Nablus was a dangerous place to go. Hebron, although it was easier to go than it is today, but it's always been a trouble spot. And of course, Yerushalayim has always been a trouble spot. And that, he explained, is because those three areas are the ones that were purchased by our ancestors, and therefore the areas that are the most connected, if you will, to the Jewish people. Therefore, they are the holiest of the three of the areas of Israel, and therefore they are the hardest to maintain control over. They are the ones that are going to take the most self-sacrifice to actually keep possession of. This he showed, as I said, with the transparency. He had the map of Israel, and then he mentioned these areas that are holier, and then he showed the 1948 boundaries, and then he showed the trouble spots in Israel today. It was a terrific, terrific class that he delivered at the time. And that's what he discussed, and that was based on these verses over here and possession of the land.
So obviously, to possess those holier spots, you need a greater sense of spirituality.
That's right.
People, right?
That's
right.
Right. We need to be more deserving. That's right. That's right.
But already foreign sensible is hard for them to catch up.
That's right. That's right. You're saying you're showing that even beforehand, the fact that they had to purchase, it shows.
And they had more merits than we.
Right. That shows that there was already a holiness
there.
Right. Right. So Chevron, we understand, is its connection. Its spirituality is the burial place of the patriarchs and matriarchs. And we mentioned last week that it seems that it was identified by Abraham as being the perfect place because that's where Adam and Chava are buried. Adam and Eve are buried. You can take the question back a step, which we're going to run out of answers eventually. Well, why were Adam and Chava buried there? It seems that this is a place which is perfect for the burial of the holy people, for whatever reason. The Temple Mount, we understand, is the place where the Beis HaMikdash is, and it is the holiest place on earth, that we understand that's where Hashem chose to make it His place. Shechem, we will have to talk about when we get to the purchase of Shechem and Parshas Vayishlach, what's so special about this place, Shechem. How does that fit in? Nobody that we know of other than Yosef is buried there. So yes, Yosef is a holy person, but all of the Shvatim, all the tribes are holy. What makes Shechem so special? That is a whole discussion in of itself, which we'll have to have as we move on through Sefer Bereishis.